From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Scott Simon, award-winning journalist, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, sports fan Quaker, and the son of a comic, has taken on a new role, author. We'll talk with him about his memoir, Home and Away. The book's focus is his life as a sports fan, but through sports he manages to write about most of the important things in his life. Scott Simon, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. The United Nations Human Rights Commission has voted to set up an international inquiry into the recent wave of violence in the West Bank and Gaza. The resolution condemned Israel for what it called widespread, systematic, and gross violations of human rights. The text also condemns what it says was a provocative visit by Israel's opposition leader Ariel Sharon to a Jerusalem shrine holy to Jews and Muslims. The violence erupted after that visit. The United States complained the resolution is one-sided and inflammatory. Israel cautioned against moves that might undermine an agreement to end the fighting in the area. It's a warning echoed by European countries. President Clinton addressed Democratic members of Congress today. He said they should take their case to the American people on Election Day if Republicans don't agree with them on education spending, the minimum wage, and other issues that divide the two parties. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
President Clinton went to Capitol Hill to talk about finishing work on the budget, but it quickly turned into a campaign pep rally for Democrats.
You know, one of the things I admire about our Republican friends is that evidence has no impact on them. And you kind of got to respect that. They know what they believe and they know what they're going to say, and don't bother me with the facts.
The president said Democrats have the issues on their side, especially the strong economy. He said Democrats will win on November 7th if they make their case clearly to the voters. He said members should still try to reach agreement with Republicans on education spending, health care, and other issues that have kept Congress in session long past its deadline. But Republicans say Democrats are more interested in campaigning than in compromise. Pam Fessler, NPR News, the White House.
On the campaign trail today in Michigan, Republican George W. Bush said Al Gore is taking undeserved credit for good economic times and ridiculed him for what he called analog thinking in a digital world. The Internal Revenue Service is launching a massive probe of U.S. citizens who have credit card accounts in offshore Caribbean banks. From Miami, NPR's Philip Davis has more.
The IRS suspects that many people holding these credit cards have overseas accounts as a way of dodging federal income tax. The IRS wants information on anyone who holds MasterCard International or American Express accounts from banks in the Bahamas, the Cayman Islands, or Barbuda. These are popular offshore banking centers because their laws protect account holders' privacy and were presumed to be beyond the reach of U.S. regulations. But the IRS argued in federal district court here that because MasterCard International and American Express are U.S. companies, the IRS can demand access to their records. If it gets the information, a team of 400 newly trained agents is standing by to begin examining the accounts. A MasterCard spokesman said the company planned to cooperate, but it also wanted to protect its cardholders' privacy. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 167. This is NPR News. In Jefferson City, Missouri, the National Guard is still working out the details of tomorrow's memorial service for Governor Mel Carnahan. Carnahan was killed in a plane crash Monday night. Steve Bell of member station KCUR reports.
Governor Carnahan will receive full military honors. His casket borne on a horse-drawn caisson, the traditional riderless horse, and gun salutes. The service will be attended by President Clinton and Vice President Gore, and the president will deliver the funeral eulogy. At the State House, staff members seemed dazed at the loss of a man who was respected by Democrats and Republicans alike. Since mid-morning, a constant stream of citizen mourners has filed past Governor Carnahan's flag-draped coffin, and outside, the sidewalk is strewn with flowers, symbols of mourning for the man many refer to as Missouri's education governor. For NPR News, I'm Steve Bell in Kansas City.
The remains of all 17 U.S. sailors who were killed last week in an attack on a destroyer in Yemen have now been recovered. The Navy says the bodies of the last four victims were removed from the ship today. 13 bodies had already been flown home to the United States. FBI Director Louis Freeh is in Yemen to take part in the investigation. Forecasters say Hurricane Michael is bearing down on Newfoundland, and it is a dangerous storm with winds near 100 miles an hour. Michael is moving west at 37 miles an hour and is expected to cross Newfoundland within the next 12 to 24 hours with hurricane-strength wind and heavy rains. Michael is expected to drop to a tropical storm by early tomorrow, but perhaps not before it makes landfall. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of The Colwood Way, a memoir, the new novel from Homer Hickam, author of October Sky.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When I'm asked who I admire as an interviewer, I always mention Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Whether he's interviewing a junkie, an author, or someone living under siege, something unexpected usually happens during the course of the conversation. Interviewing is just part of what he does. He's an extraordinary reporter who has covered stories in all 50 states and several war zones. His gifts as a writer help make his reports so compelling. I recently had the pleasure of reading his writing in his new book, Home and Away, Memoir of a Fan. The book is organized around his passion for sports, particularly baseball and basketball. But sports connects to nearly everything else that Scott is passionate about. So this memoir is also about family, religion, politics, show business, and journalism. Here's a brief reading.
I am the son of the funniest man and the most beautiful woman in Chicago. Although my father felt that my mother won both titles after she was once asked, "What's it like to be married to the funniest man in Chicago?" And she replied with a skillful deadpan, "I wouldn't know." Outsiders often find it difficult to trace my family and the ties that bind us. I grew up accompanied by a compelling assortment of irregular, unrelated uncles and aunties with Jewish, Catholic, and agnostic allegiances, all abounding in the same group of people we considered family. We think of this as being as American as cheese enchiladas. My father's family descends from Spanish Jews. My mother's from Irish Catholics. Both sides came to America through Montreal, but like many on this continent, we despair of tracing our ancestry back much further and frankly don't much care. Neither side seems to hold much promise of a moneyed inheritance. Both the Sullivans and Simons seem to have been city folks, whether Belfast or Toledo, Montreal or Chicago, and both sides seem to have earned their way in this world by the sweat of their smiles instead of their brows. Jesters, sellers, jokesters, hucksters, and, to be sure, a few cons.
Scott Simon's father, Ernie Simon, was in show business. Scott saw nothing unusual in that. He used to ask other kids, "What's your father's act?" I asked Scott about his father's act.
My father's a comedian. My father told mother-in-law jokes. He told occasional son jokes. He said, my wife, Patty, is expecting another child. And we went to our little boy, Scotty, the other day and said, Scotty, mommy's pregnant. Would you like a little baby brother, a little baby sister? And Scotty said to me, "Well, Dad, to tell you the truth, if it doesn't throw her too much out of shape, how about a pony?" he told dialect stories of a kind you probably should be careful with these days. He would tell Irish dialect stories, my mother's family being Irish. He would tell Yiddish dialect stories, his family being Jewish. I'm trying to remember a really tasteless joke. Not tasteless.
This is what I would encourage.
I'm sorry, I forgot where I was for a moment. Yes, of course you would encourage a tasteless joke. Well, all right, this is a joke he used to tell that I think you have to be careful with these days.
Okay, yeah.
There's a Yiddish phrase, visakstu, which I'm told essentially, I shouldn't say I'm told like I don't know Yiddish, but I mean this one I'm not familiar. Essentially means, I guess, what's new or how are you? It's a greeting. And my father told a story about an old Jewish gentleman who grew up in the west side of Chicago, who took the bus back to that neighborhood, and it's now no longer populated by Jews, but by African Americans. And my father, I think, when he told the story, certainly used to say Negro. Older Jewish gentleman gets off the bus and encounters a Negro man and says, "Vasakstu." And as my father told the joke, the Negro gentleman would say, "Well, I think they split a doubleheader with the Yankees yesterday." Well, you know, it's not a bad joke, but you just can't tell that kind of joke nowadays and get away with it.
Was it ever embarrassing for you if your father was flopping and you were watching him, or if he was trying to tell jokes at a dinner party and the jokes seemed kind of tasteless?
I don't remember.
Or merely bad.
Yeah, I don't remember that happening. I remember being with him on one occasion when he was telling jokes at a benefit for something. This was at the in the somewhere on the north side of Chicago, a place called the Villa Italy, as I recall, something like that. It was a benefit for muscular dystrophy or something. And without putting too fine a point on it, he had something to drink. He'd had too much to drink, and he was just. That it wasn't notably drunk, but it was lousing up his timing and it was lousing up his memory. And I remember wanting to crawl. Yeah, it was terrible. That was a bad night. It was worse for him. And I think what probably prevented me from being too shattered is that, I mostly had to cheer him up.
Right.
Everyone was incredibly nice about it. I do remember that. George Kirby, comedian then, black comic who did a lot of impressions, great impressionist. I don't know where he is. I haven't seen him in years. But George Kirby was kind of the star of the show, and he was just such an absolute and total gentleman, and came over and put his arm over my father's shoulders, and said something about, well, you know, sometimes you just don't know what the bastards are going to do. You were terrific, and he said to me, "Your son, your dad is just great," and he was just wonderful. But it was that. Yes, I remember that distinctly.
Did your father give you advice about how to tell a story or how to put across a joke?
You know, he did, interestingly. And as I look back on it, I think I write in the book that I hope I'm past the point. There's some people that pretend for the rest of their lives that everything their mother or father said was some golden nugget of wisdom. And while I respect and admire both my mother and my father a lot, they're human beings and are probably just as right or wrong as I am. I'll give them benefit of the doubt, more right than I ever will be. But on the other hand, we're not talking about 100% ratio there. I think he was utterly right about this, which is that the most successful jokes are told on a rhythm of three. You know, one, two, three, and then you deliver the punchline. And I guess, come to think of it, I've probably never forgotten that in my work. When I'm writing a script, if I'm looking to make an analogy, I usually try and do it on a rhythm of three because I think there's something to it. You know, the stool doesn't fall that way. I think you maintain harmony with a rhythm of three.
Do you have a good joke to illustrate that?
Can I tell one that my father used to tell in
the book?
Sure,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I hope it's not a man goes into a bar and says, "Look, I've got a dog who can talk." And the bartender says, "That's ridiculous. Dog can talk." He says, "No, he can talk. Look, looks down at his dog and he says, "Okay, what is on top of a house?" And the dog goes, "Woof, woof, woof." Bartender says, "Oh, buddy, come on, you're testing my..." "No, no, come on, give me another. I'll give you another chance." Turns to his dog and says, "Okay, what holds a tree in at the ground?" And the dog goes, "Woof, woof, woof." Bartender says, "Buddy, come on now. I don't have all..." He's all right, let me try one more time. He looks down at the dog and he says, okay, "Who is the greatest home run hitter of all time?" And the dog goes, "Woof, woof, woof." Bartender says, "Buddy, I've had it with you. Don't darken my door." So he throws the man and his dog out. Man and the dog are standing in the street. Dog looks up at the man and says, "Perhaps I should have said DiMaggio." I love that joke. And it works under, one, two, three, and throw the punchline.
My guest is NPR's Scott Simon, the host of Weekend Edition Saturday. And he has a new book, a memoir that's kind of a fan's memoir, a sports fan's memoir. It's called Home and Away. Your parents divorced as a kid. Mm-hmm. You were a kid mm-hmm. when they divorced. Your father, who...
My mother was a kid, too, come to think of it, yeah.
Your father had a drinking problem, and he yeah. continued to drink, and sometimes he'd drink when you were alone with him, and yes. it was your job to keep the secret. What did you think of keeping a secret when you were a kid? Or having that burden of keeping a secret?
You know, I think because my parents at that point were divorced, I understood it. I just knew as the son of a mother and father who I love very much that it was my job to keep each of their secrets and keep them from each other. I think I recognized that they were both going through terribly rough times. I suppose I was too. and that in a way, one of the greatest gifts we could give one another would be to respect that privacy that way. I don't think it extended to all areas of my life, but I really do think it extended to that one. So when my father never said to me, "Don't tell your mother I'm drinking." I mean, he tried to hide it from me, but not very successfully. He never had to, really. And for that matter, I think my mother knew when to stop prying. I mean, what else could she do? Mm-hmm. Her heart had been broken by his drinking. To a degree, her life had been splintered. Their lives together and their life with me had been splintered. So I don't think she wanted to exact any further pain from him at all. Quite the opposite.
Did you try to convince him to stop?
No, I did not. I didn't know how to do that. I was young at the time. I didn't have the wherewithal. I didn't know how to begin that conversation. I didn't know what to say. Among regrets I have in my life is that I couldn't figure that out. Let's put it this way. When I was, I think, in my late teens and early 20s, I settled on that as one of the great regrets of my life, that I'd never been able to find the wherewithal to say to my father, "Stop drinking, you're killing yourself." As I've gotten older, maybe to let myself off the hook, although I hope not, I think that wouldn't have made any difference anyway. That's what happens when you're an alcoholic. Nothing is more important than that, which doesn't mean that he didn't love me, because he certainly did, loved my mother greatly. But not that he loved alcohol, but it was a sickness, an addiction, and that became the thing he had to add in his life, I think, above and beyond his son and his wife.
You were 16 when he died. It was shortly after Robert Kennedy's assassination.
Same month.
Shortly before the summer of the Democratic Convention in Chicago. Mm. And you write in the book, it seemed the decisive sign, your father's death seemed the decisive sign that the world would not wait for any of us to grow up. The anguish and the dying overseas and in our own streets was going on now. It must have been an incredible summer for you, because so much was happening politically and you lost your father at the same time.
Yeah. And Chicago was the fulcrum of that.
Yeah,
because the Democratic Convention was coming there. The Weatherman Days of Rage would occur there. Chicago became the fulcrum of a lot, and certainly of my family.
And it was a period when a lot of people, in addition to protesting the war, were rebelling against fathers in their own home and father figures at universities. And you were losing your father. And so I'm wondering if you think that losing him affected how you expressed yourself politically during that period of protest.
Yeah, I've thought about that over the years. And interestingly enough, the last conversation my father and I had, aside from saying goodnight, was some sort of dull argument over the war in Vietnam. My father, being a child, I mean, he'd been an adult during the young adult during the World War II generation, had I think it's safe to say a different view than I had at that particular point. Scotty, you got to stop the bastards when you can. And in any event, it was a dull argument. I mean, we would have continued to have that argument. It was never very serious, because in many ways I think he was sympathetic to what I was saying, and in many ways it must be said I was sympathetic to what he was saying when it was applied to World War II. But I think after he died, I became a little bit more galvanized in the movement. Who knows, it might have gone that way anyway, but I think, for one thing, since I didn't have him as a father figure to rebel against, I think I might have fixed some of that on our society generally. And I think I also had even then at the age of 16, I think I had a sense of increasing mortality. I knew that kids I was going to high school with were going to be drafted, probably going to be drafted, and quite possibly sent off to the war in Vietnam. That would have been a possibility for me too, except I refused to register. But that's another story, perhaps for another book. And quite openly, I mean, I sent a letter. And in any event, I think I had a sense that this is the one life we're going to have. And you can't wait to become 21 to participate in the life of the world. When things are going on at that particular point, you have to find a way to participate there and then. And I think it probably, and I became much more of a student activist.
Now, your grandfather on your mother's side was a cop.
He was a Chicago cop.
And in fact, he was one of the cops assigned to the area around
around
the park during the convention.
He was actually at the convention center at the Chicago Stadium.
Okay.
I was in Grant Park.
Oh, okay.
Thank God, because then you would have had the makings of some kind of a Greek tragedy if my grandfather had been beating kids in Grant Park and suddenly he had swung his baton and came down on his grandson's head. But in fact, I wasn't touched by a policeman and he was over by the stadium. So our family was spared that. There were other families, kids in the park who undoubtedly had that experience, though. God bless him. My grandfather did not have that gift, I think, of being able to separate that. People had to just accept his. I wish I could say otherwise. He just could be a terrible bigot, you know. I think it was all rhetorical. I hope it was all rhetorical. But I should note for the record, when he died in 1969, there were an awful lot of black cops and an awful lot of Hispanic cops who came to his funeral. I don't think any Jews aside from me. But perhaps I underestimate him. But he was relations were rockier. Also because he had locked my mother out of his life at one point after she had married a Hebrew, as he referred to Jews. And although she, God bless her, had repaired relations at one point, it was rough.
My guest is Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. His new memoir is called Home and Away. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Although Scott Simon and I are colleagues, I rarely get to see him or talk with him. I work at WHYY in Philadelphia, and he works at NPR in Washington. So it's a pleasure to have a chance to talk with him about his work and his life. He spent most of his adult life working in public radio. So have I, and I'll give you my reason. I can't think of any other place on the radio where I could interview the people I most admire, as opposed to being pressured to interview people who may be popular but have little to say. We all have our reasons for valuing public radio. I hope you consider your reason to be worth the price of a pledge. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, and now author of the book Home and Away. It's a memoir, much of which revolves around sports, but through sports he writes about just about every other aspect of life and journalism. During the late 60s, when you became active in politics and political protests, you were writing at the time for an underground newspaper, mm-hmm. So you were still a journalist, even back then.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if being a journalist then put you at times in a slightly more comfortable situation, in the sense that I remember at a lot of political protests then, everyone had to decide, okay, if things got a little violent, were you going to pick up a rock and throw a stone? Were you going to yell taunts about the cops? Were you going to break a window? Were you going to insist on being peaceful no matter what other people were doing around you or no matter what the police were doing to you? And you had to really figure out a strategy and then try to stick with that. And were you willing to get tear gassed? Were you willing to get clubbed? And as a journalist, you perhaps were a little bit more on the sideline observing and
yes.
not having to think that much about how far you were comfortable going and what you thought was appropriate and inappropriate in protest.
You know, you're absolutely right. That's true. And I think it was, looking back on it, the first time I understood why journalism can be a wonderfully compromising profession. Because even if you come to it with strong ideology, you run into personal flesh and blood examples that have a way of violating it. I mean, I in 1968, at the time of the convention, we came out with an issue of Offset Magazine, it was called, which is our underground magazine we were putting out. And I had this long pseudo-mailer-esque treatment of the 1968 convention, a Democratic convention in Grant Park. And at length, I had quoted, there was a young man there who was a soldier. He was a Vietnam, had been served in Vietnam. He was back. And he was being restrained, it must be noted, by some of the National Guardsmen. And he was yelling. He was very moving as he was yelling epithets at the hippies, as he called everyone. Is that something to the effect that you damn hippies, you never worked for anything in your life, you know, you haven't been scratching around, in the mud and the blood like me and my buddies. What the hell right do you have to be out here and be saying these things about your country? And he was very moving. And stopped me for a moment, made me think. Didn't make me support the war in Vietnam, but he made me think. I mean, I will say now, I think the people, the predominant number of people in the park had the right idea, but I think he was right to say that, that we always didn't have the moral standing to be able to make that argument, because I think we obviously were young and had not witnessed as much of the world as he had.
You got involved in political organizing for a while. You ran the campaign for Chicago City Council candidate.
Ran it into the ground. A very nice man named the Reverend Chuck Geary.
Why did you briefly want to get into political organizing? I mean, voting booth kind of politics.
It seemed the logical thing to undertake after, I think, what we had been through at that particular point. In 1968, I'm sorry if it sounds like ancient history, I think there was a feeling that there was a lot of ferment and tumult in the country, and that the two people who wound up being nominated for president, Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey, were not the best logical result to grow out of that tumult. And I know I felt at the time, well, we have to start organizing politically to elect people who will reflect viewpoints that are closer in accord with our own. And a good place to do it was on the local level. And Chuck Geary had been an old Appalachian American organizer, a man who believed in multi-ethnic democracy, who had been organizing Appalachian and black workers there in the uptown area of Chicago. And I liked him very much, and it seemed like fun. And I had been state student council president, so of course I was perceived to have all kinds of real
world.
What
was your campaign slogan?
For state student council president?
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember. I remember my campaign slogan for when I was safety commissioner in seventh grade. as a matter of fact,
what was that?
Safety first, Scott. I can still sing the theme song, as a matter of fact, and I don't get a lot of requests for that. But I don't remember my slogan as state student council president. Poor Chuck Geary. He was a wonderful guy, and I shouldn't say poor. Poor Chuck Geary, just because I mismanaged his campaign. Our campaign button were five stripes of color to represent the five specific groups that lived in the uptown area of Chicago. So there was white, brown, black, red, and yellow. And that was our campaign button. You know, what a shame we couldn't have managed to put the candidate's name on that button. I think we were just so conscious of being politically correct that I think we forgot to be politically effective. And we really figured out at the end of the campaign that if we had gone out in the street and offered people $5 to vote for him, we would have gotten a bigger vote than actually campaigning and passing out leaflets, you know? I think we just denied that we were living in Chicago.
Scott Simon is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. His new memoir is called Home and Away. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, becoming a Quaker and pacifist, then reporting from war zones. We continue our conversation with Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. He's written a memoir called Home and Away.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Scott has reported from all 50 states and from 8 war zones and has won broadcasting's major journalism awards. He's written a memoir called Home and Away. During the late 60s, I think one of your favorite writers was Norman Mailer.
Yes.
A writer who had a reputation for, among other things, being a real two-fisted writer. I mean, he'd get into fights, verbal and physical. Mm-hmm. He was hard drinking and so on.
That's not what I admired about him.
I was wondering if you ever thought about yourself, well, maybe I'm too nice.
Oh, I don't know. I've wondered about that. People have suggested that about me over the years. I mean, that's a common complaint that I hear every now and then. And let me assure you, I'm not. I mean, I'm not two-fisted or a big drinker or anything like that. But on the other hand, I also know I'm not too nice. I can be as mean-spirited and malevolent as anybody else in this profession.
But you probably wouldn't punch a person.
No, certainly not. Absolutely not.
When you were in your teens, you became a Quaker.
Yeah.
Now, your father was Jewish, your mother Catholic.
Catholic.
Why did you become a Quaker?
Well, it must be said both of my parents were seekers. So I went to Buddhist services, Pentecostal, Presbyterian, Universalist, Congregation, a whole slew of different kinds of services. And what I immediately liked about Quakerism, must be said during that time, particularly when I was in my adolescence and early teens, the Quakers are pacifists, and this was occurring at a time. It was really even somewhat before the war in Vietnam became an issue in my life, so much of the civil rights movement. And I very much admired the audacious way in which pacifists were affecting social change. As Gandhi used to say, it's not as if there won't be losses, but there are losses in war, too. I very much, as Gandhi also used to say, that if you win your revolution through violence, then the people who will take over, the people who are the best perpetrators of violence, and that's often not a good result. So I really admired the ways in which Quakerism had used pacifism to try and effect social change. I also, Quakerism is a religious society as opposed to a religious organization that insists on soul fealty. And I became very comfortable with the fact that I could both be a Quaker and yet still honor the faiths of my parents. I could continue to participate in Judaism and Catholicism without a feeling that I had to choose between the two. I also like the Quaker concept of prayer, it must be said. Quakers, at least in North America, don't have prayers. They don't sit down and intone to the Almighty asking for things, which has always baffled me a little bit. The Quaker silence is intended that you leave your heart and mind and soul open to hearing something of God that is within each of us.
Now, along with your Quakerism, you became a pacifist. And I found it really interesting in your book, Home and Away, you talk about how in covering war in Kosovo and in Bosnia, you decided that there are places where war is justified, where fighting back is justified. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about that change of heart? Not a disavowal of pacifism, but a kind of loosening up of...
It brought me face-to-face with its limitations. That being said, about half the draft-age Quakers and Mennonites here in North America during World War II enlisted on the feeling that whatever Quakerism had to give the world, it was probably an insufficient answer to Adolf Hitler. Now, in none of the conflicts that I had ever covered prior to Bosnia had I ever felt that way. I still feel, by the way, that the situation in the Middle East could be better addressed by massive campaigns of civil disobedience rather than violence. Didn't feel that way about the war in El Salvador. Certainly didn't feel that way about the Gulf War. I could go on and on. But it wasn't until I got to Bosnia that I confronted the fact that Bosnia didn't have an army when that conflict began, that if people did not react with violence to the violence that was perpetrated on them, if they didn't fight back, all of the good people, all of the people who believed in a multi-ethnic, tolerant democracy would be slaughtered by all the worst people, who were the racist, murderous thugs across the hills in Pale, who were members of the Serb army. And I just couldn't accept that. As I told a lot of Quakers at the time, I would rather be morally mobile and inconsistent than to be a good Quaker on this one. I just felt the stakes were too high.
Well, I like the way you found it comfortable, acceptable to be inconsistent.
Yeah.
Sometimes inconsistency is something that you won't allow, that one won't allow oneself, and therefore one gets painted into a corner, forced to be a hardliner in a view that they don't really want to be.
Yeah, no. I thought certainly, I became pretty openly on our air and certainly in Quaker meetings, I don't mind saying, an advocate for involvement of the West in trying to deter the Holocaust that was going on there. And I thought that was important and urgent, and that people who had a strong conviction should not stay silent about it for one nicety in their life or their professional vocation for another. And I still feel strongly about that.
My guest is Scott Simon. His new memoir is called Home and Away. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. His new memoir is called Home and Away. It's somewhat paradoxical that someone who is as opposed to war as you are, opposed most of the time to war, should have spent so much time covering it. You've covered a lot of wars over the years as a journalist. I know part of that is wanting to bear witness to what was happening and to explain it. But I'm wondering if you've ever thought that part of you maybe had a taste not to fight a war, but to see it, to be in the middle of it. I always think that there's something going on when somebody voluntarily.
Yeah, I've wondered about that over the years. I wouldn't have wondered about it so much if it was just one or two. But I think when you get to eight, the question is justified. Perhaps I will point out that the best stories are there.
Yeah.
And that really does drive me a lot. I also have felt that you shouldn't leave the covering of war to people who believe in it. Necessarily, treat it as if it's just a kind of more lethal form of sports, and so I've always felt strongly about that. Also, you begin to learn more. You begin to feel about things. You have a certain base of knowledge, and you feel driven to use it. I think all of that contributes to something. I don't know. I mean, I would do it again. It depends on the circumstances. I mean, I'm not a professional that way. I cover a lot of things, but I think those stories can be important and involving. They're very much worth covering, and I think they ought to be covered not just by people who think that violence practiced on a mass scale is a perfectly acceptable way for the world to acquit itself of its business.
Now, how have your mechanisms for dealing with what you're seeing and then reporting on it changed over the years? Like the first time when you were seeing people being killed in war, your reactions must have been much more kind of extreme than after the Eighth War when you had seen it often.
I think it comes and it goes. The first time, it happened on, I believe it was my third day in El Salvador. The first time I ever saw people killed in front of me was also the first day I ever came under fire. And I had been warned that when that happens, you either cry or mark your laundry, as we say, you can follow what I mean, or laugh. You can probably guess I was a laugher. None of the circuits that I had in my body at that particular point were prepared to accept or process that. I just, on top of everything else, it was just absolutely incredible to me. Now, I had covered some instances of violence in Chicago, domestic unrest and riot and all that sort of thing, so I knew people could be mean. I could not understand how people could kill each other. I don't want to say in cold blood, because to them it wasn't cold blood. They felt there was a battle going on. I just couldn't see why somebody didn't stand up and say, wait a minute, Do you understand? We're going to kill each other. Let's just stop this. What is this all about anyway?
What exactly happened?
Their fighting reached the capital in San Salvador, and we were at our headquarters there in San Salvador. It was in the northwest quadrant of the city, and we just drove out there with our van and driver. And we of course, could hear the shooting, and we decided to... We could see, actually, rebel soldiers who were wearing masks and shirts and blue jeans. And I still remember this distinctly. On the right side of these streets, the small calles that were leading down from the hills, and on the left side, they were the government forces that were trying to bear them back. Looking back on it now, I think the rebel troops were trying to escape. They had launched a raid at launched a raid in a local police station. They were trying to get out without too many casualties, and they had sort of gotten caught up in a bottleneck in the small street. So we could see this because the rebels in particular were trying to get up the hill, and the government soldiers were pursuing them. So we told our driver, Armando Hollado, to go down closer so that we could see it. And at first I was struck by the fact that there was really something obscene in us watching this, like it was some kind of a sporting event. And Kim Conroy, my producer, and I got out of the van and began really walking, because we had no sense of physical hazard at that particular point. And then the shots began to go near us, and there was a whiz, and I must say, without getting dramatic about it, I mean, you feel the wind around you rustled. There's a percussive effect that happens. And thankfully, we got behind a staircase and just... then the fire became pretty withering over in our direction, but we were, as it turned out, obviously all right behind that staircase. I ad-libbed in News Spot, by the way, because we didn't have cell phones in those days. And this is such an NPR story. Ultimately, when we could get out of there, we drove back and filed the News Spot that I ad-libbed under fire. And the man working who took it in said, "Well, you know, it's very dramatic, but there's really no analysis of the political situation in there, so..." My editor, John McChesney, who now reports on new technology for NPR, apparently did some scenery chewing at that particular... "I've got a man down there risking his ass, and you people won't put this on..." So it eventually got on the air. But
it became a kind of famous piece within NPR,
became, yeah,
too.
No, yeah, it did. But in any event, it's... I think what happened... pretty much that afternoon, what happened is that the circuits in my body just kind of got soldered. You know, they just sort of came together flat, and I just began to operate on another plane that was professional. And I think over the years, that is probably what has happened. I'm not out of touch with the misery that I'm seeing, or the pain, the loss, the suffering, the insensate violence. But there's something that kicks in that is professional, and that's the level on which I operate. All of which is a way of saying I think I would go nuts if all I could do was just look at this and have nothing to do. Maybe I would pick up a rock, pick up a gun. I've always had my work, which I think of as kind of cathartic just at the personal level.
And when you would do the algebra of how much of a risk am I willing to take for a story, what's the biggest risk that you took?
Well, I think the biggest risk I ever took was probably something where the algebra was obscured. This was in El Salvador. We decided, a group of us, whose names I will probably keep private, decided to go out. The Arena Party, the right-wing military party, was putting up these banners. The International Prensa International, "Di la verdad, tell the truth," to taunt us. And one night after curfew, a group of us went out and tore one of them down. That was the most stupid thing that I think I have. No, we were perfectly fine, but that was the most stupid thing I think I ever did.
Why? Why?
It was after curfew. We could have justifiably, by the laws of that country, been shot. And for what? You know, for a prank. I think other times. I tell a story in the book about when Manoli Wetherill, my erstwhile longtime recording engineer, and I were in Sarajevo. We were doing a story on pets because we were very impressed by the way people in Sarajevo wanted to keep their pets in their lives, and sometimes really heroic measures they would. Interesting, by the way, I don't call any sports figures heroes, but I will call the people of Sarajevo heroes, undertaking heroic measures to care for their pets. And we came under fire in this open park that had been denuded and shorn of trees, doing a pet story. As Manoli said, "I don't want to get shot doing a goddamn pet story." And yet, had you said to us at the beginning of the day, you can do this pet story, but you might get shot for doing it. We never would have done it. I'm glad we did this story. But on the other hand, I mean, for Manoli and I, on Leo Delagola and I, who all the three of us have been to a lot of places over the years, Peter Breslow and I were in Kosovo, I think we've all made decisions where, no, this is just another shoot 'em up. I don't think we're going to go there today. But on the other hand, sometimes you have to do that. But most of the time, you really don't get to make that choice, though. It just kind of bursts around you.
When you've been under fire in war, is there a voice in your head, like your father's, for instance, saying, the show must go on? And, you know, like, no matter what, you got to...
No, it may be a terrible thing to say, but absolutely there is. Sure there is. I remember once when Kim Conroy and Leo Delagola and I had to run across the street. We came under fire in a town called Suchitoto one day in El Salvador, and we were kind of we'd all three of us just mashed ourselves down into a gully, and they were firing over the road. This went on for about 20 minutes, and the firing let up somewhat, but not totally, but enough so that we thought we would take a chance on getting up and running across. Because on top of everything else, you don't know if it's sniper fire, the snipers are going to reposition themselves. So we thought we would run across the road to get over behind a wall that was a kind of a church school, Roman Catholic compound there. And in any event, so we all agreed to do this. And I remember saying, okay, are we ready? And I said, yes. And I said, are you rolling? Because, well, if something had happened, I hate to say it, you want that to be on tape. Leo has that tape in particular, as a matter of fact, because when we finally get behind the wall, the three of us were smashed together again, really almost like a scene from the Kama Sutra. And in any event, Leo, as Peruvian-born gentleman, says to Kim Conroy, our producer, oh, I knew you could not resist me forever, you skinny Irish girl, you. So, and I think what happens is you can't have a high state of nervous tension for probably more than 5, 10, 15 minutes at a time. At some point, it has to break out. Leo is also a laugher. I think at some point, it has to break out. And I mean, over the years, that's how people find the wherewithal to persist, I think, through these terrible situations. It's astonishing to me how quickly people make the transition into living inside some kind of hell.
You make a nice connection in your book between a lot of the things that you write about, which is your father being in show business, you being in journalism, a lot of the people you most admire being sports figures. And talk a little bit about what you see as connecting that.
It depends on the circumstance and the performer, but I think at some level, everybody involved in all of that has some aspect of their lives and their profession, which is performance. And I think proudly so. There's no reason to be embarrassed about this. And I like to think that part of what we all share that we can give to people who listen to us, watch us, whatever, is a kind of catharsis. I mean, I think sports has the same cathartic elements as good drama. Or bad drama sometimes. It allows you to take yourself outside of your skin, put yourself into somebody else's skin, and to inhabit their world for a while. I mean, certainly I think just about the most valuable stuff I've ever been a part of in journalism does that. And in a much different way, I think sports performers do that, and certainly people on the stage, be they comedians or tragedians or any kind of actor, does that too. And I think it involves, on the one hand, expressing yourself to the audience, and on the other hand, I think when it's most effective, you have to have a sense of yourself, at least as a performer. I've always kind of not understood it when people say someone will dismiss an actor's performance by saying, oh, he or she was just playing themselves. Nothing is more difficult, I think, than to play yourself. And people are, as it's been my experience, as a generalization, they don't go into drama or acting, the stage or theater, because they're entirely certain who they are as themselves. So that's why they shuck other personalities off and on. And look, I wish I could say it was otherwise in broadcast journalism, but I think a lot of our colleagues, God bless them, of the fine, wonderful people and my best friends, people with an identity crisis are not unknown in this business. Let's put it that way. And I think to be most effective, however, you have to both be able to take on an understanding of somebody else's personality while also expressing that through the channels in your own body that make the most sense and allow you to be the most expressive.
Scott Simon, a real pleasure to talk with you.
Pleasure to talk with you.
Scott Simon is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. His new book is called Home and Away. This is Fresh Air. Scott Simon's reporting, interviewing, and essays help define what makes public radio unlike anything else on the radio band. And yeah, another thing that sets us apart is fundraisers like this one. Let me explain why it's important for Fresh Air fans to call with a pledge. Your station pays a subscription fee to carry Fresh Air, and that fee helps fund our program. In order to pay that fee, the station needs Fresh Air listeners to pledge. So let me remind you that there's a direct correlation between your pledge and your ability to continue listening to Fresh Air. Thank you for your support.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine, I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those Stumbo bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer, first rate chums I attract. All I can say,
Gwen Verdon died yesterday at the age of 75. She was considered one of the greatest dancers in Broadway history. She starred in Damn Yankees as the devilish seductress Lola. On that show, she worked with choreographer Bob Fosse. He became her mentor. She became the dancer who best interpreted his work, most notably as the star of the show's Redhead, Sweet Charity, and Chicago. I spoke with Gwen Verdon in 1993, and we played her big number from Damn Yankees.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets, and little man, little Lola wants you. Make up your mind to have no regrets. Recline yourself, resign yourself, you're through. I always get what I aim for, and your heart and soul is what I came for. Whatever Lola wants.
I think Damn Yankees was the first Broadway show that you worked on with Bob Fosse, who later became your husband.
True.
What was it like the first time you worked with him and danced to his choreography? What was different about his choreography and direction from what you had experienced before?
The first thing that I noticed was it was so amusing. I know it was sensuous. I know it was all of those things, but it was done with such a sense of humor, and also done with the innocence of a child. So you weren't acting sexy. It just came out that way. Nope. And I was amazed at the training, because I had excellent training in many disciplines of dance. And I was amazed at how disciplined and what was required with Bob's work.
What was required of you that you...
Ballet, tap, isolation, which I had learned from East Indian dancing. And, I mean, there was his humor. I had worked with Jack Cole, who always did very sensuous women. He did Gilda for that number, Gilda from the movie, Gilda for Rita Hayworth. I think he's probably more famous for that number. But it's not funny. And Bob would do the same kind of thing, not the same steps, but his point of view was the flip side of that. It was just making fun of being sexy, which comes out much more sexy.
Do you feel that you played Lola, the devilish seductress, as funny?
I played it as a child. Have you seen little girls all dressed up in their mother's clothes,
mm-hmm.
You know, and lipstick smeared all over their face? I did it like that.
When you said that there was isolation required for Bob Fosse's choreography, do you mean like just moving one shoulder or an elbow or just like one part of the body?
Yes. And it was extremely musical. That was up to Bob. I mean, the music was the groundwork, but he would catch every little thing. If you moved your little finger, there would be a ting on a triangle. So, and there was an economy to the movement. You didn't just sort of blast out and dance. It was isolation and discipline. That's the only thing I can think of.
Would he do the moves to show you what he wanted?
Yes, and they were hysterical. And I once said, I don't think I can do that in high heels. So Bob put on high heels and did it.
Oh, so, no.
Oh, absolutely.
So,
well, he believed me, but he had to find out for himself.
Well, could he do it in high heels?
Sure he could.
So then you were forced to do it.
Not forced. I thought, oh, as soon as I could see how he did it in heels.
Well, what was the trick?
It was not a trick. It was a certain step in Lola where you keep twisting, and I kept thinking the heels are, one heel is going to scrape by my other foot.
So what was the solution he came up with?
Just do it. And if you're turned in enough, you have to be very turned in, which worked just great for me because that's how I studied dance. That's how my mother taught me when I was two.
Gwen Verdon recorded in 1993. She died yesterday at the age of 75. We also lost a great singer yesterday, Julie London. She died at the age of 74. We'll close with one of her best-known recordings. I'm Terry Gross.
Now you say you're lonely. You cry the long night through. Well, you can cry me a river. Cry me a river. I cried a river over you. Now you say you're sorry for being so untrue. Well, you can cry me a river. Cry me a river. I cried a river over you. You drove me, nearly drove me out of my head, while you never shed a tear. Remember, I remember.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In other words, who's on first? We got a show to do here.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, two jazz pianists who are also singer-songwriters, Dave Frischberg and Bob Dureau. They performed together on their new CD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Am I the appetizer? We better negotiate. Say I come up and get roaring.